Life is filled with challenges and opportunities. That's a pretty broad statement. Covers a lot of ground. And I'm sure we recognize that, yeah, there are many challenges and there are many opportunities. The reality is we may have difficulty at times distinguishing which is which. Because what we may see as a challenge may turn out to be an opportunity. Recently, one of our neighbors was evicted from the house that they had rented for 10 years, given about 40 days notice, which was a little bit of a challenge for a grandma, a divorced mom from an abusive situation, and her daughter, for them to try to sort out, organize, and pack up everything to move. Fortunately, some friends and a neighbor were able to help with the arduous process, which took a lot longer than anticipated because of the quantity of stuff and the things that they had to deal with. But even with the incredible challenges for them, this has the opportunity to be a great opportunity for a fresh start. It could be something good that could come from it. Now, we may have observed that in our own experience. And the nation Israel had many challenges and many opportunities as well. Most of the challenges were of their own making. We can relate to that because we find ourselves in similar situations. But most of the opportunities were of the Lord's making for them, trying to move them in a direction that they needed to go because of the plan that the Lord had in mind for the Messiah to come through them. Sometimes the challenge for one person or group is an opportunity for another person or group, and this was the case in Israel's history in relation to Babylon. Israel's demise would be an opportunity for Babylon to prosper because they would make off with all their goods, everything that came from the temple. They would have the acclaim of conquering this people and so on. So it looked like it was a good thing for Babylon to overtake Israel, and thinking particularly of Judah here as the subset. But then we also see in the scriptures, and we'll see in our text today, that Babylon would also come to its demise, and it would be an opportunity for Israel to return from captivity and to have a new life and a fulfillment of promise that the Lord had made to them. So we want to think about this passage that we're looking at today. And this is part of the middle section of Isaiah that has to do with the Lord's redemption, or the Lord's provision for his servant Israel. Now, we know there's another servant that's referenced, and that'll be coming up in later passages, more particularly speaking of his servant Messiah, has been previously touched on a little bit. In chapter 44, verse 24 of the section that we're looking at here, it talks about the Lord, your Redeemer. And we see that referenced a few different times in this section, chapter 44, 23 to 47, 15. And we're kind of in the tail end of that section as we're looking at this chapter today. But this section has an announcement of redemption from captivity, chapter 44, verses 23 to 28. It has an identification of the instrument of redemption, which would be Cyrus, chapter 45, verses 1 through 13. And this would be at the expense of Babylon. And then chapter 45, verse 14 through 46, 13, there's a reminder of the uniqueness of this God, who is the God of redemption, the Redeemer. And we see how many times he's referenced as no other God, the only one, and all that, in contrast to the idols. But this section that we're looking at here concludes by depicting Babylon, the nation which the Lord would use to redeem his people from captivity, it was really the nation that had put them into captivity, but now he's going to be redeeming them from them. And it's depicting Babylon as a proud woman in self-confidence and daintiness and all of that, and that's going to come to a stark conclusion here. And in her case, as with many others, it was a matter of pride going before a fall. And so here in this section, we have an oracle against a foreign nation. Well, we've seen that in the book of Isaiah already, chapters 13 through 23, particularly focused on all the different nations, what was going to come of them. Babylon was included in that, and Babylon's been touched on as well as Assyria. They were the main players at this time. Jeremiah 46 to 51 deals with that, Ezekiel 25 to 31, so the other passages that deal with it. But also included in this section is an oracle of deliverance for Zion, God's people. And that's part of chapter 45 through 46 in particular. But the main part of the chapter that we're looking at today is going to be dealing with Babylon's fall. But that's really a backdrop to the bigger picture of the glory and power and grace of Yahweh, the God of Israel. That's going to be taking place through the demise or destruction of Babylon. So what can we learn from the demise or this discourse against Babylon? It's not just in Scripture for no reason. There's something here for us to learn, and hopefully we can pick up some things. So the first thing we want to recognize is the vulnerability of those who are in opposition. That's those who are in opposition to God, those who are in opposition to His people. And so we look at the text beginning at verse 1 and on through verse 4, and we'll take this in a couple of sections. Come down and sit in the dust, O virgin daughter of Babylon. Sit on the ground without a throne, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no more be called tender and delicate. Take the millstones and grind meal. Remove your veil. Take off the skirt. Uncover the thigh. Pass through the rivers. Your nakedness shall be uncovered. Yes, your shame will be seen. I will take vengeance. I will not arbitrate with a man. And so that's kind of giving an introduction to what's going to be the emphasis of this chapter. But then there's verse 4. That's sort of really the essence of what's significant here. As for our Redeemer, the Lord of hosts is His name, the Holy One of Israel. That's kind of tucked in here, not by mistake, because it's really the defining factor of what's going on with Babylon, and it's indicating who is orchestrating what's going on here, and that is the Lord of hosts, our Redeemer. So, there would be a reason to mourn and not reign. That's part of the emphasis as it relates to the word against Babylon here. And then there's this virgin imagery that indicates her unconquered state. Babylon is presented as a nation or as an empire that had not been previously violated by others. The words virgin daughter personify the people of a city as a young innocent girl. That's been referenced previously in Isaiah 23 and chapter 37, probably meaning that the city's walls had never been breached. They'd been able to stand against any others out there, and therefore they were feeling pretty good about themselves as being able to take care of themselves. But this is showing a contrast to that, because here it's indicating Babylon is going to be humbled like a servant or a slave and sitting in the dust. And it might be somewhat of a reminder of Israel's anticipated condition, that they would be in the dust as well, caused by Babylon. And if you recall, Psalm chapter 137 talks about, by the rivers of Babylon we wept. And they were finding themselves in dire straits because of the Babylonian captivity. So it's language that might be helping put things in context here. The mourning slash delicate imagery indicates vulnerability. They thought they had everything together, but they're going to end up sitting in the dust, which would be an act of great mourning, as we saw depicted in Jonah chapter 3 and the book of Job. He found himself in states of great mourning as well, sitting in the dust heap in the trash area. She thought, that is Babylon, and we have this she imagery, which kind of is reminiscent of what we find later on where Babylon is referenced in the book of Revelation. So there seems to be somewhat of a correlation here of some future kinds of events that are going to be taking place. But she thought that she would be a queen, that she would be recognized as having a pinnacle position, an empire that for a time was the greatest known power for at least a limited period of time. And it caused other peoples to think that they were superior, and they were ready to recognize that that certainly is the case. The reference to the Chaldeans, that's somewhat of a subset of this people. They were residents of the southern area of Mesopotamia, and they had been leaders in throwing off the Assyrian dominance that had been going on for a significant amount of time previous to that. So the picture is this nation that had it all together is now going to be in a state of mourning and vulnerability. And they are going from a state of power, authority, high esteem, abundance, to a state of weakness, suppression, humility, and deprivation. Now, this has happened to a lot of people over the history of the world, where somebody's on top for a while and then they're at the bottom. And kind of makes you wonder if there's any concern that we ought to have as a nation that is now in a state of abundance. We're on top of the world, and how long is that going to last? History has shown it doesn't usually last all that long. You get a little bleep of time, and then, so what does that mean for us? Might give us reason to heighten our prayer life just a little bit in that regard, how to think about our own nation. There would also be the removal of adornment for shame. As conquered servants, they would be forced to take on the menial tasks of a slave or a servant, such as the grinding of flour. That would be where they had been the high-class folks that would have had their own servants. Now the people who had their own servants would be functioning like servants. That's kind of the picture that's there. Instead of being on top of the world, they would now be suppressed and oppressed. And so it's that picture that's coming on them. Kind of reminds me of the fate of the evil sister and stepmother of Cinderella in the movie Ever After, if you've ever seen that, where they were conniving against Cinderella to have the king fall in love with this other daughter, and it turned around, they ended up being servants because of their conniving and evil plans, and so it's a similar picture. As conquered servants, they would be unable to worry about matters of clothing or modesty. That would be, in some ways, the least of their concern with all the other things going on. They had been recognized by their fine attire, and that would now no longer be something that would cause them to stand out as being important or of having their culture and all the things that would be associated with that. There's reference to going across streams or rivers that might be focusing on being taken captive or maybe being on the run, all of which is not a particularly positive picture. And then there would be those who, or at least the imagery is that those would be taken advantage of, even raped or abused. Again, this vulnerable state is the picture that's being communicated here. And the idea of being uncovered is a matter of being shamefully exposed. And whereas this nation, Babylon, had been the supreme people, the ones that were in control, they were in charge, and they were the high class, having abundance and all of that. Now, they're no more significant than anybody else, and probably less so. And so God is taking vengeance on Babylon, and he's putting them in their place because they had exalted themselves. And he's not sparing them the humiliation that they are deserving because of them exalting themselves in a position that they had, but there were some problems with the attitude and the actions that they had been involved with. And so the whole picture is God is going to shame them. He's going to put them in their place. And it's a reminder for us. What about our nation? Are we going to be in a place of being put to shame, of being humiliated, or even as individuals in whatever context? It's a little disconcerting, perhaps. Then there would be the result of deliverance for God's people. This is the emphasis of verse 4. This verse brings perspective and context. It's coming back to, well, the Lord is driving things here. He's the one who is accomplishing his will for the sake of his people, which is for the sake of his promise that he has made to them for the accomplishment of the provision of salvation through Christ, which is yet to come. So it's really a big deal, and this is put in here for a reason, to give that perspective. It's indicating that God is the one who is holding all people accountable, but he's also a God who is true to his promise, and he's going to bring about redemption through his work with his people and through the person who is going to come through his people as well. This verse also indicates God's primary role and focus, that emphasis on the Redeemer, the one who provides. And he has the wherewithal to do it, the reference to the Lord of hosts, of armies, of angels that he has. So he's the one who can provide both judgment for Babylon and deliverance for his people. And sometimes he brings judgment to his people and blessing to others. But it's to accomplish his purpose and his promise that he has made. Then there's the matter of the serious sins of those in opposition. And here we look at verses 5 through 7. We read, "Sit in silence and go into darkness, O daughter of the Chaldeans, for you shall no longer be called the Lady of Kingdoms. I was angry with my people. I have profaned my inheritance and given them into your hand. You showed them no mercy." Now, he's indicating something about the way the people of Babylon viewed themselves, like the Lady of Kingdoms, like we have the premier position here. But then he's saying something about, now, I allowed you to function as the instrument of judgment or discipline on my people, and you went too far. You didn't have mercy on them. You showed no mercy. On the elderly you laid your yoke very heavily, and you said, "I shall be a lady forever," so that you did not take these things to heart nor remember the latter end of them. They were not taking to heart who they were dealing with, both in God's people and dealing with God himself. Now, you can read this in a lot of contexts with a lot of nations who find themselves in a similar situation where they don't take to heart who they're dealing with. A nation is held accountable for its mistreatment of Israel. We've seen many passages that deal with that going all the way back to Genesis chapter 12. And so that's not surprising. Babylon would lose its position of world prominence, something that it had greatly reveled in, and they would no longer have that position, be the queen of nations, having other kingdoms under her authority. And rather than enjoying the public activity and the promise prominence that goes with being the leader, Babylon now would find herself sitting in silence and in darkness. And so it's again that movement from a position of prominence to the exact opposite. And it's a matter of judgment because of how they dealt with the Lord's people. Babylon would reap the consequences of its mistreatment of Israel. Babylon had not been kind to the people of Judah that the Lord had allowed to go into their hand. In a sense, she had not really conquered Judah. God had given over Judah to the Babylonians because of their sinfulness. And yet they worked fully in their own freedom to do so. And the Babylonians had been unmerciful toward the Israelites and had made life hard for them, particularly even for their elderly, what they had them go through. Just think about the movement of people from the area of Judah, particularly we're talking about here, and making the trip to go all the way back to Babylon. Just that trip itself would have been a major thing, particularly for someone who is more advanced in age, and that's part of the picture that's communicated here. Now, what's also interesting to note is that the Babylonians were not as hard on the Israelites as what the Egyptians and the Assyrians had been. It was more the matter of their arrogance than their physical cruelty that had made them unmerciful. And the marks of Babylon's arrogance were that she had assumed that she would continue to rule the world forever and pretty much felt like she could do anything and get away with it and it would be just fine. I mean, she had defeated Assyria with the help of the Chaldeans and they all kind of joined together, which had been the most powerful ruler for 300 years. That was Assyria. They had dominated for a good long time, and now Babylon thinks, well, we've taken Assyria down, so now we're the top dog, and there's really nobody on the horizon that can threaten us, so we feel pretty confident that we can pretty much do whatever we want, and was feeling self-sufficient and self-existent, didn't need anybody else, and so the Lord is going to be kind of putting them in their place. And that's going to be a blessing ultimately for his people because they had been mistreated beyond even what the Lord was offering them. And that's not surprising that people tend to be given a little and take a lot. Then looking at verses 8 through 10 of Isaiah 47. Therefore hear this now, you who are given to pleasures, who dwell securely, who say in your heart, I am and there is no one else besides me. I shall not sit as a widow, nor shall I know the loss of children. You can see the arrogance in that kind of mentality that's communicated there. But these two things shall come to you in a moment, in one day, the loss of children and widowhood. They shall come upon you in their fullness because of the multitudes of your sorceries, for the great abundance of your enchantments. For you have trusted in your wickedness. You have said, no one sees me. Your wisdom and your knowledge have warped you, and you have said in your heart, I am and there is no one else besides me. Now, just think back to a couple of verses or the previous chapter where the Lord said, I am, there is no one besides me. And it's like they're trying to act like they have every bit as much authority as God or in his place. So a few things to think about here. Those given to pleasure and wickedness are in for trouble. That's pretty obvious. Those trusting in their security may be in for a surprise. Well, they were enjoying pleasure and felt like they were secure, but they're going to be disappointed. That's the emphasis that's here. They were given to self-focus and all of the things that they were focused on, they would be losing. And the ravages of war would take their toll in human terms, and they would lose the family members. They would lose husbands in this process of the fighting that was going to take place when Cyrus and the Persians and the Medes take them over, and it's going to lead to their demise. So with all their confidence, it wasn't enough to keep them afloat. And it was a problem of putting their trust in other things. And part of what they were putting their trust in was the sorceries and enchantments, the things that their wise men were involved with. That we'll look at more in a moment. Those feeling secure in their wickedness are deluded. Well, there's a lot of delusion going on in our world today. When you look at this text and you start making some comparisons, you see, wow, there's so much here that's kind of similar to what we're dealing with. Babylon was sensual in that she was a lover of luxury. She had assumed that what she enjoyed were her rights by virtue of her superiority. Now, not that anybody in our culture would act that way, but you don't have to look real far to see something of a comparable nature. Her present condition had led her to think that she would always enjoy provision, protection, status, security. Well, don't we kind of act that way? I mean, we've enjoyed a great amount of the comforts of life, security, status as a nation. How long is that going to last? Well, we're at a time right now where we see things deteriorating before our eyes, and it's becoming more evident that it's not a certainty that things are going to stay the way they have been. We can't be confident in that. There could be judgment coming down that we may be working toward. So there's obviously things to think about there. So in spite of what the many things that this nation had been relying on, God was going to bring judgment. But what was it that she was relying on? Well, she had made great movements in the direction of advancements in the magical arts. And this part of the world was known for that at the time. And the association was so strong that in Daniel, the term Chaldean was used for magician. Chapter 1, 20, 2, 227, and so on. So those were noted that that's what they were identified with. And, of course, you remember Daniel when he was working in the local government of this nation and this area. There were many magicians that were referenced there. And he was among them, but he wasn't the same as them. And he stood in stark contrast to them in terms of what they were trusting. The Babylonians had a great interest in astronomy, but that moved in the direction of astrology. And it's interesting that the names given to the astrological constellations today are translations of the ones originated by the Babylonians. So that was part of what they were all about. So when we see this reference to their sorceries and enchantments and all of that, that's part of the picture. That's the case here. It's their magical incantations. That's what they were trusting in, and their prognostications regarding the future and all of that, and it turns out they were insufficient. They may have been trusting in them, but they were going to be inadequate. Their great knowledge of many of these things were things that they were, again, trusting in, and it sort of puffed them up, and it turns out they were delusional in trusting in those things, and the Lord was going to put them in their place. And that's part of the humiliation, the deserved humiliation that's coming to pass. And we can think about our own nation and what we're trusting in and all of the things that are going on that people look to today. It's kind of interesting where they get their confidence, their sense of security. The coming doom of those in opposition. Looking at the next few verses here, verses 11 through 13. Therefore, evil will come upon you while you're trusting in all of these other things. You shall not know from where it arises, and trouble shall fall upon you. You will not be able to put it off. And desolation shall come upon you suddenly, which you shall not know. Now, I don't know if you can see much up here, but this is Mene Mene Tekel Upharsin. The words that were written by the mysterious hand where the people of Babylon were taken over in one night. And so, again, that's a prediction that was very specifically fulfilled. Then starting at verse 12, stand now with your enchantments. Basically, it's saying all this evil is going to come upon you, or these events are going to come upon you. It's going to come upon you in one night, and you're going to it's going to be a shock and a surprise. So then, will you be able to rely on those things you've been relying on? Stand now with your enchantments and the multitude of your sorceries in which you have labored from your youth. Perhaps you will be able to profit. Perhaps you will prevail. You are wearied in the multitude of your counsels because of their wise men. You're wearied by it. It's not really helping you. Let now the astrologers, the stargazers, the monthly prognosticators stand up and save you from what shall come upon you. And that's obviously being a bit sarcastic there. The circumstances of life can change very quickly. Now, that's a reality that we're familiar with. There are, in our own experiences, we've seen that kind of thing happen where we think everything is moving along just the way it should, and then something can happen and it totally throws everything off. Well, that's what the case was with Babylon here. A serious calamity would come upon Babylon unexpectedly. In spite of how or what the Babylonians thought, God would bring judgment on them suddenly. And that was the case. Daniel 5 describes Belshazzar's feast, which took place on the night Babylon fell. In one night, it says in the text, toward the end of chapter 5. Cyrus took the Babylonian king and his city completely by surprise, and the empire fell overnight. And so, by morning, as one commentator put it, every citizen of the empire was not a Babylonian but a Persian. That had changed that quickly. And again, this was a case of pride going before a fall. You recall that Belshazzar had ordered that they take the instruments, the instruments for, like, cups and so on that had been used in the temple and used them for their drinking party that very night. And so it was really a blasphemous kind of thing. And the Lord said, enough's enough. Now's the time. It's over. And so the Lord accomplished his will through another pagan power. And the Lord is able to do that. And he's able to do it through the human free will of those people and accomplish his act, which shows that he truly is sovereign, and overall he is able to work within the parameters of the human freedom that he has put in place as well. Calamity would come in spite of their trust in the occult and all of those things associated with it. And so the Lord here is sarcastically challenging the Babylonians to continue to trust in their mediums and horoscopes and all of the other things. Hey, how's that working for you? Go ahead. Trust in it. See if that'll pull you through. They weren't about to humble themselves like the Ninevites did when Jonah came to them. Of course, Jonah wasn't exactly excited about that. But they had quite the disposition that needed to be put in its place, and the Lord was happy to accommodate that. So their wise men were not able to pull them through at that time. The flawed dependence upon occultic resources continues today, and it's been around for ages. You think about the number of people that there are in our culture that look to occultic things and give any credence to it whatsoever. I mean, think of the books that have been written and all of that. Just recently, Susan had a meeting with a lady, and at the conclusion of the meeting, the woman said something about going to get the newspaper so she could check her horoscope. I was like, really? And how's that working for you? I mean, what is that going to accomplish? What are you going to do with it? It's just crazy. But that was just recently. And so it continues. And you think, how would somebody who has the apparent level of sophistication that this person had, how would they see to do that? And yet, it seems to be a popular thing. So we need to, in our culture, with all the kind of stuff of that nature that's still going on, we need to be like Daniel, who, even when you're in the middle of that culture, you stand firm to what's true and right. Even when the pressure is coming at you, we need to have that same kind of resolve to stand for what's right and true. Then looking at verses 14 and 15, the last of this chapter, behold, they shall be as stubble. The fire shall burn them. They shall not deliver themselves from the power of the flame. It shall not be a coal to be warmed by, nor a fire to sit by. A fire is an interesting thing because it can be a real blessing, because we need to have fire to cook food, to stay warm, you know, all this kind of stuff. But, boy, if it gets out of control, it is a real hazard. So that's kind of the picture that's given here. Under control, it can be a really good thing, but when it's taking over, then look out. Then verse 15, thus shall they be to you, with whom you have labored, your merchants from your youth. They shall wander, each one to his own quarter. No one will save you. So there's some things to note here. The practical consequences of faulty dependence are serious. When you're depending on the wrong things, it ends up poorly. And that's where we need to be careful when to evaluate our own situation, to think about, now, what am I really depending on? Am I depending on the Lord? Am I depending on His Word? Am I taking His truth to heart? Or am I depending on my own provision or the things of society, the tidiness of my own schedule or organization that I've put together for my existence? Is that what I'm depending on? Or am I depending on the resources that I have, that I've put away? And you see all the I there? I've. And the Lord says, well, yeah, you kind of need to be doing these things, but are you depending on those things, or are you depending on me? And so that kind of comes back to remind us. They would be unable to resist the fires of judgment. And this, obviously, there's some element of a metaphoricalness here that's here. But the Lord is going to judge. And all of their occultic powers, their political powers, would not stand up to the judgment of the Lord. And just like a little teeny tiny fire can go and become a huge wildfire, the Lord's judgment is going to come in, and there wouldn't be anything that could stand in its way. Not any of their astrologers or their prognostications or anything else of that nature. As a matter of fact, those things would be burned up in this metaphorical sense, and they would come to nothing. And the false religions that are out there don't have anything to offer to stand in resistance to the fires of judgment that come from the Lord. And so he puts those into place that need to be put into place. So one commentator had said this: these few words at the end of verse 15 capture the whole argument of chapters 40 to 47. Everybody needs a Savior. The emphasis here was, no one shall save you from the judgment of the Lord, but there is someone that is the Redeemer, go back into verse 4, who does save, who does provide. He does deliver in the temporal sense, in the physical sense, and that's usually the emphasis, but also in a broader sense, in the spiritual sense. He says everybody needs a Savior. The gods of the magic and the magical worldview on which they rest cannot save. The Lord, who stands outside the cosmos and directs it according to his good purposes, can save. And then he says, which shall we choose? What's going to be our emphasis? And that's obviously a good reminder for us. Those who have turned from trusting the living God in their daily routine and are instead looking to the horoscope or any of the other kinds of things of our society ought to pay attention to this passage, because it kind of puts it in perspective. Also, they would be abandoned by former allies. It's talking about the powerful merchants of their day that they would look to. I mean, it's like our country as well. Who's going to pull us through when we go through the hard times? Well, it's those people who have the resources, the wherewithal, to help us through. Well, it's saying here that they're going to be hanging out in their own quarter. They're going to say, I'm not following with you. You guys are going down the tubes. We're going to go and do our own thing. And that's kind of the emphasis that's here as well. They're not going to stick around and be available to help bail them out. And it kind of causes us to think about our own nation. How many of the resources are going to be available as our national debt continues to escalate? And those who have resources, are they going to say, I think we need to put this on an offshore account somewhere, or in Switzerland, or wherever else, because we're not sure that things are going to hold up here? And you can see a similar kind of mentality that's communicated. And who would have known that the Bible would talk about something like that? But here it is. So again, it comes down to dependence. What are you depending on? This whole matter of faulty dependence, and how easy, even for Israel, God's people, to miss the mark. They too often were depending on other things, and the Lord had to call them back. And Babylon was depending on other things, and the Lord would call them to account. And is he going to call us to account as well? So, some final observations here. The point of chapters 41 to 47 is that the entire structure and system of the Babylonian Empire, represented by her idols, as was often the case, referenced in the previous chapter, was developed by humans. It was a humanistic kind of development, going all the way back to the Tower of Babel. You know, Babel, Babylon, kind of a connection there. Babel's been around for a long time. And the same area, same people groups, basically, were involved there. Different empires or kingdoms at different times. But Babylon is often used as an imagery for a human contrived entity. And that's why it's not surprising to see it referenced again in Revelation 17 and 18 as depicting the systems of this world that are of human development that are in contrast or in opposition to the God of the universe. So that's the picture that's there. Just as an idol is a human fabrication with no autonomous power or usefulness of its own, so the entire Babylonian system of society, economics, and politics was a human fabrication that would, in time, collapse, like so many other nations. Which again reminds us, what about our nation? How long do we have? But then in contrast, part of what was communicated, particularly in verse 4, Israel must reserve her worship, her ultimate commitment for Yahweh, because Yahweh is the Redeemer. He's the Holy One. He is the Lord of hosts that they need to look to. And they need to have a commitment to Him that goes above any other thing that you may be depending on. And likewise for us. Don't be depending on all these other things. Depend rather on the Lord. So the text points out the problem of faulty trust and self-exaltation. When we start relying on these other things, we think that we've done it, that we've got it together. And pride, as we know, goes before a fall. And as we've also recognized many times, it's one of the most delineated sins in the Bible as being of a greater seriousness than most anything else. Satan was the poster child for the sin of pride, if you remember, from Isaiah 14 and Ezekiel 28. And so in light of that, there are many probably that deserve humiliation today. Hopefully we're not some of them, but as a nation we probably are. And it causes us to wonder when or who is next to experience that kind of humiliation that is a potential reality. We know that it's going to hit Babylon again as whatever, either physical or metaphorical sense, in the book of Revelation. But one of the things that we need to remember is that all people are accountable to the omnipotent Lord, who is Lord over all. And the Lord's people have a special place in His heart. Not because they're better. Not because they're more of them or greater or in any way meritorious. It's because they're in a special relationship with Him. And that relationship was one that He initiated. He provided by the Messiah who was coming through them. The Messiah, the Christ that we look to, who has died on the cross, paid the penalty for our sin, and we know that we receive the benefits of that provision when we put our personal faith and trust in Him alone. And that's what we need to be reminded of. What are we trusting in? Are we trusting in God's provision of salvation through Christ and the implications that come from that, the certainty of His Word, or are we trusting in things that we've put together or the things around us, our nation, the political machinery, the economics, or the material? Are we trusting those, or are we trusting His provision? Good reminder. He has a way of putting things in their place when we get it wrong.